Welcome to another exciting episode of Not in a Creepy Way, the podcast where the Brothers Anderson will dig deep into the movies. The Brothers Anderson are, this is Eric.
By the way, you know, when you're telling these little stories, here's a good idea. Have a point. It makes it so much more interesting for the listener.
This is Brother Jay.
You ask me if I have a God complex? Let me tell you something. I am God.
This is Drew.
There is a storm coming like nothing you have ever seen, and not a one of you is prepared for it.
And they're sometimes joined by guests like...
This is Dr. Wonders.
I had to stop her from screaming.
And Diane.
If you men only knew.
So sit back, close your eyes, and let us take you away. Unless you're driving, in which case keep your eyes open and watch the road. And, you know, anyway. Christmas. Ho, ho, and ho. This is Eric.
And this is Drew. Merry Christmas.
And tonight's Christmas movie is going to be the least Christmas of any movie I think we do on this Christmas season. And that's 1991's The Last Boy Scout.
Yeah. A movie that was not quite what I remembered it to be.
Me either. I have some strong opinions about this movie, and I had to kind of, I think, like, sort of retcon and figure out why it was the kind of movie that it was. Because it was definitely a specific thing.
Okay. Well, I will be interested to hear what you think that thing is.
Yeah. But first, a little bit of housekeeping that I had to stop editing, and I went and sought out and watched The Little Match Girl.
Oh, how did that go?
Well, I knew it was going to be dark, so it didn't take me by surprise. But I could definitely see, I could see where it affected you, because there was no way out of it. Like, once you were in it, it was not going to end well, and it was not going to. And it's a short, so it's not going to take long to get to that bad spot.
Yeah. Did you watch any of the other shorts, or did you skip right to that one?
I pretty much skipped right to that one.
So just to frame it a little bit more, I think the one in front of it was about a cat who got cursed to dance with his tail. So it was pretty whimsical, and then there may have been something else in between, but pretty soon after, then there's this story, and I didn't have any idea that it was going to be dark, so... I was approaching it rather cheerfully, and again, we're starting to work on like empathy in our children, and trying to teach them to understand that not everybody has the same advantages that they do. So when my oldest was watching it and wondering why the girl didn't have any shoes, no, I was really trying to engage her and talk about how, well, she doesn't have any shoes because she doesn't have any money because her family's poor and they can't afford it, and... And so while we're watching it, she's asking why she's selling matches, and so again explaining to her that, you know, she doesn't get to play like other girls. She has to try and sell matches because she's not as fortunate, and she has to work. And so it's already like getting really kind of sad, and you know, then we start talking about how like it starts to click, and Elle was like, but if she doesn't have any shoes, her feet are going to be really cold. Yeah, and kind of thinking about, like, that's kind of heartbreaking. And yeah, and then when the fantasy started, at first, it was like, oh, she gets a little bit of relief. But even then, the fantasies only last as long as the matches last. And at the end, I genuinely thought... That was like a nun who was actually going to come save her and take her to an orphanage. But they did not go to an orphanage.
And, I mean, I like the fact that, you know, kept sort of chasing the dreams. And then at the end, like, much like a kid, she just, like, lit all three of her last matches. And, yeah.
And froze to death.
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess it was a happy ending because she left the mortal coil. And so, you know.
She froze to death in a Disney cartoon.
Yeah, yeah. That she did.
I still feel really blindsided by this whole experience.
And I wasn't sure if it was a racial thing, too. Because didn't it look a little like Mulan?
I thought it was in Russia.
Yeah, yeah, it was in Russia, but she didn't look particularly Russian.
Oh, I didn't pay that close attention.
Yeah.
I thought the music was really, like, hauntingly beautiful, though.
Oh, yeah, no, and I thought that actually the style of animation was great. And the fact that there was no, you know, there were no words was pretty great. But, yeah, dark.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, not the kind of thing you're expecting when you're trying to get to Frozen Fever.
Yeah, or some crazy Tangled thing, or... I mean, like, the... did you happen to see the short in front of Inside Out?
I think so. We have Inside Out.
The volcano one?
It's not ringing a bell.
Oh, no, you would know it. It's all about volcanoes, and there's... it's two animated volcanoes fall in love. And I think it's called, like, I Lava You.
Oh, that's hilarious.
Yeah. Well, it's cute, and it's, again, it's a short, so it's a thing. And, you know, it's really pretty, and the music is, you know, sort of goofy ukulele, but it's not the Little Match Girl, that's for sure.
Oh, man.
Also, here's
That one wrecked me.
Yeah, I agree. I'm glad you warned me about it, and I'm glad you didn't just ruin it, and so I experienced it. Had it been like a 2-hour movie, I just would have had you ruin it for me, but for a like 3 or 4 minute short, it was fine. The other thing I wanted to say is, so to make up for that, nothing gave me more joy than, even though it took me all day and I was sort of sweating it because I usually have the episodes way out by Sunday morning. But Sunday evening, when I put it out, or late afternoon, I guess it was evening, nothing made me happier. Have you listened to the episode yet, The Rounders?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we barely talked about the movie.
Yeah, I know. It was great. It was fine, though. The stories were fantastic. And nothing made me happier than to put in the Christian Bale quote. Yeah, anyway. Okay, so are we ready for The Last Boy Scout?
I'm ready.
1991. Now, did we watch this in the theater together?
Yes, we did.
I remember enjoying it, I think. I certainly remember the opening, not the opening credits, which I really love, by the way. We'll talk about that in a second. But I remember the opening scene. I didn't remember that it was Billy Blanks, the creator of Tybo.
Right, yep.
But I definitely remember that scene. But... this was an interesting movie for me.
Yeah. Well, let me tell you what I remembered about this movie.
Okay, please.
I remembered the opening scene. The opening scene always stuck with me. There is a scene later when Bruce Willis is trying to have his cigarette lighted. I remembered that scene when that's the scene with Kim Coates, the dude from Sons of Anarchy. And then I remember the scene at the end when they're talking about how it's the 90s. You can't just walk up and punch somebody. You have to say a cool line first. Those are like the three things that I really remembered about this movie.
Yeah. And even from the beginning of this movie, you know, you could tell it was a Shane Black script. And actually, I think if this wasn't the most expensive Shane Black script ever, it was his first major payday. I think he got $1.5 million to write this script.
Not too shabby.
No, it's great. And it's there's lots of little quippy writerly things in it. The dialogue is sort of snappy. It's not up to par, I don't think. I think it's not as good as he got in lots of other stuff. It's no Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. It's no Lethal Weapon, even. It's a little bit forced, I think. Or maybe that was just performances.
yeah, I don't know if it was writing, performance, directing, or editing, but there was something off about this movie. It felt immature, not like juvenile, but it felt like it was created by someone who is still figuring out their craft. So if you had told me that this was Shane Black's like very first major script, that would make sense to me. So the fact that it's not really makes me wonder what happened.
Well, and also, you know, Tony Scott is a good director. I think we always love Tony Scott. Granted, he's better in action than he is in the rest of the scenes, but. Like, I don't have a problem with the direction of the movie, necessarily. And I don't have a problem... Some of the acting is questionable. But I really had to, like, go back and look at the overall historical context of the movie. Because the movie kind of left me really cold. When I was... like, I'm watching it, and so I'm getting... You know, it's got all the right beats to it. It's an action movie, and it's got some funny points in it. And it's got some serious stuff kind of really, really ham-fistedly shoved in. But, so I'm kind of following it along like that. And I thought the action scenes were pretty great, uniformly. And I thought the characters were pretty, pretty interesting. Although, again, not necessarily very likable. I mean, one of the notes I put was that this is a buddy movie where neither buddy is very likable at all. Like, you know, Damon Wayans should be super likable, fish out of water, and Bruce Willis should be like hardened, you know, sort of beaten up, chewed through the machinery, but also still likable. And I don't like either of the characters.
I didn't like anybody in this movie. I didn't even like the daughter.
Oh no! Although I did like, I thought the daughter had the funniest line in the whole movie, and Danielle Harris is actually, you know. I've enjoyed her films since Halloween 4 and 5, all the way through, you know, current horror movies. And I think she's a main voice actress in The Wild Thornberries, too, so I've heard her there, too. But, yeah, I mean, except for me, I really liked, I always liked Taylor Negron. He's great. But, yeah, everybody else, not so great. Not very likable at all.
You mentioned that this movie left you cold. I did not enjoy this movie. This was a chore for me to get through. And it really surprised me because I had fond memories of it. And when it started out with the whole Bill Medley version, their own version of the really cheesy Monday Night Football intro song. I thought that was hilarious.
Oh, I loved it.
Yeah, I was in. I was like, okay. I don't remember this, but now at least there's something demonstrating about why I remember liking this movie. But that was about it. I mean, yeah. There's a couple other moments that were amusing, and the action was well done, but, man, yeah, it's something about this movie. I mean, it was really clunky. It didn't make any sense if you thought about it too hard. And, yeah, neither one of the leads were likable.
No, and, I mean, I've got a theory, and it's not certainly unique to me, but... Now, looking at this thing historically, because Roger Ebert gave this movie 3 stars. And I'll get in. I don't know. Did you get to read any of Roger Ebert's review of this movie?
No.
It's very interesting. There are so many reviews of this movie that one of them compared it to a war crime. Not Roger Ebert. He was actually much more complimentary. But yeah. Okay. So here's what I read about the history of it, and see if this makes sense at all to you. I think this suffers from a time and a place because, you know, this is just after Lethal Weapon, but it's also just after Hudson Hawk. Now, did you see Hudson Hawk?
I have never seen Hudson Hawk.
Me either. But Though my understanding is that Hudson Hawk was supposed to be kind of a charming, silly comedy, but it was overwritten and it was marketed as an action movie. So it was a complete flop. And I think Tony Scott, Days of Thunder and something else didn't perform as well as it should have or whatever. So he was coming off of that. But it seems like they went after this movie as a big fuck you. Like, the whole thing is like, okay, you want an action movie? We're going to give you an action movie. We're not going to give you a charming comedy. This isn't going to be charming at all. You know, this is going to have the familiar beats of a buddy movie, but it is going to be stripped down to its bare essence.
So you think they're giving it like the Primer treatment?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. Or I'm trying to think of another example of, you know, you want this kind of movie? We'll turn this up to 11. Because there was lots of swearing. And again, nobody's very likable. And there's no, I mean, it's weird. It's when we get into the plot and we can dive in here pretty quick. But yeah, it's some stuff is just kind of thrown at the wall, I think, here. But yeah, no, I have to remember, or have to point out that, yeah, that opening credit scene with the Bill Medley doing Friday Night's A Great Night for Football. I think that's actually better than the current Sunday Night Football theme.
It could be. It was amazing. And it was not at all abbreviated.
No, it was. And do you know who wrote it?
No.
It was written by John Bettis and Steve Dorff, which is Stephen Dorff's dad. And no relation to Brad Dorff.
Oh, your favorite Dorff family.
Exactly, yes. Yeah. So he wrote it, and Bill Medley sang it, for real. And yeah, it was an entire thing. It was crazy, and it was so pitch perfect. I mean, it was great. And then you get this kind of gritty football opening, where you have this, you know, and for me, when you throw the fake football teams in there, it takes me out of it a little bit, kind of like how whenever you see the character write down the phone number that starts with 555.
Right.
So the L.A. Stallions playing on Friday Night Football, you know, okay, so fine, I'll just suspend disbelief. And you have Billy Blanks, who is a running back high on PCP, who in order to win the game brings a gun onto the field and shoots the opposing team as he's running for a touchdown, and then kills himself.
Yeah, that was a really iconic opening. I mean, I've always remembered that.
Oh, it's dark. Like, the locker room is crazy dark. You know, I kind of wonder if there are locker rooms, like what the Cleveland Browns locker room is going to look like.
My favorite part of the locker room was the coaches were giving like the worst like halftime pep talk ever. I don't know if you picked up on that.
Oh yeah, like get in there like a hog or whatever, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, and then it was all dreary and dark, and then the guy coming, phone call for so and so, which is hilarious because on one hand you think, well, would that really happen? On the other hand, I can totally see NFL players just taking a cell phone call in the middle of a game too. But
sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Why not? Really. But. Yeah, so it's this is a football movie, sort of, briefly. And then, so you got that. So you got the rousing opening, followed by this batshit crazy football with a gun story. And then you end up with hard-boiled private investigator Joe Hollenbeck, Bruce Willis, who is sleeping in his car and gets waken up by some kids who are messing with him and throw a dead squirrel at his car. And that's kind of straight out of Lethal Weapon. Like, that really has that kind of feel to it.
Yeah, but also it is the hero of the movie being introduced by pointing a loaded weapon at children.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. The beginning of... This is a movie that has been accused of a little bit of misogyny. And probably, like misanthropy as well, but yeah, this movie doesn't have any strong characters, and its kids aren't really portrayed as being ideal either. Also,
no,
the backstory for our hero Joe is too big. He can't be a disgraced Secret Service agent who at one time saved a president from assassination attempt and then lost his job because he discovered his other political client abusing a prostitute or whatever, and then got fired for political reasons, and then ends up being just kind of a drunk. I think that's too high profile.
Yeah, and the backstories for both the leads are really shoehorned in. Like, the one for Jimmy Dix is worse.
Oh, it is. Absolutely.
You know, when they're finally relaxing at Joe's house and he pours a drink, he's like, "A toast to my dead son. Let me tell you, he died."
Oh, and
it was a car accident. It's like, just out of nowhere. You're like, what's happening right now?
Yeah, it's also unnecessary because, you know, later on, you know, he gets fired for gambling, and yet he has this drug problem also, and he's got kind of a kind of a powerful speech about, you know, getting hooked on drugs because your knees are shot because you're an athlete, blah blah blah. And then gambling is, you know, one of those necessary things. And why do you think they have an injured list for football? They don't have that for other games. It's all about gambling. I mean, I thought that was very powerful. You don't need a dead kid and a dead wife.
Nope. And it never even comes up again.
Yeah. Yeah. Completely innocent. You also don't need to have Hollenbeck saving the president. It's just not necessary. You're right with Dix. It's just shoehorned in. It breaks the pace of the scene and everything.
Yeah, and I understand why they included, you know, a backstory where Joe saved the life of the president, because you needed some reason to root for him. But that was also just kind of thrown in there.
Yeah, and again, you could have made him a war hero. You could have made him you know, a cop, or even, I guess, even a federal agent or whatever that does something very heroic, but not very many people know about. But he would be in the news, you know?
Oh, absolutely.
So, from the get-go, he is super unlikable. In fact, he looks at himself in the mirror and does his daily affirmation, which is,
"Nobody likes you. Everybody hates you. You're gonna lose. Smile, you fuck."
And then he says, "Smile, you fuck." He's not winking. Yeah, he's a broken guy. So, yeah. But that's not the worst part of Joe's day. He ends up going home to his wife, who he's somewhat estranged with, and discovers through his excellent detective background that she's got a man in the apartment, and there's a funny little scene where we discover it's his best friend, Mike Matthews, a guy who actually just offered him a job, who's played by Bruce McGill, who does an okay job. I mean, he's a familiar face. But Joe's wife... So Joe's wife has got a guy at home, and Joe is really bitter about it, and I can see where having, you know, so Joe is just so far down, he's not going to give anybody anything. So the wife wants him to get angry, and Joe's not going to give her that, he's not going to give her that satisfaction. So, yeah, I mean, other than being like having witty repartee, Joe's not likable at all. He's just angry. And the other thing about this movie, and again, it's like flashing back to Joe's past, how you find these things like little by little, and where Jimmy tells his story about his dead kid and whatever. You get the story, you get the impact of the scene, but you have no time to sit in it and appreciate it. It just immediately goes, okay, here's the story. Boom. We're not going to give you any time to use that to like any character or get a mood going. We're just going to change the mood right away. So Joe's angry at his best friend. He's like, he's angry at the wife. He's angry at the best friend. He punches the best friend. And then the best friend gets blown up. And he doesn't react in any particular way to the best friend getting blown up anyway. So you don't get any, you have no time at all to take these little threads they give you and weave it into anything. It just moves the story along.
No, the main characters in this movie do not give a shit about the people in their life.
Yeah, or themselves.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, his best friend gets blown up, and he just kind of shrugs it off and goes on to the job that he was supposed to get paid for. And then pretty soon thereafter, the other main character, Jimmy, experiences the loss of someone very close to him, and he doesn't even really get too broken up about it. They just move on.
Oh, yeah, and let me tell you, when people experience a loss in this movie, it's pretty brutal. I don't actually remember it being so brutal when the client, whose name is she's a stripper named Corey, played by Halle Berry. Yeah, when Corey gets shot, it's pretty darn brutal.
She gets Sonny Corleone'd.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I had no memory that Halle Berry was in this movie. And I had no memory of what happened to her character. So that was, all that more shocking.
Yeah, because that's, I mean, again, the women in this movie, you meet Joe's wife and she's not very likable. You could kind of maybe feel for her, except you don't get any time with her anyway. And Joe hates her, or worse, is just done with caring about anybody. And yeah, and then Halle Berry, you get a little bit of interaction between she and Jimmy. She's got some sort of plan to get Jimmy his quarterback job back. Oh, and by the way, how we meet Jimmy is in the LA Stallions compound. And one of the linebackers or whatever is basically drowning a girl who won't give him a blowjob.
And in a hot tub.
Yeah, in a hot tub. And it's kind of played for laughs, kind of, but it's not really very funny.
No, but, you know, it is absolutely played for laughs.
But it's not funny. It's not. It's horrible.
It's set up to make Jimmy look like a hero because he throws a football at the guy's face. But really, that's, you know, how many times did he watch the girl almost drown when he was like, dude, come on. Dude, come on. Dude, okay, I'm going to hit you in the face now.
Yeah, exactly. Ugh. But yeah, so we have a scene of what's supposed to be snappy patter inside the bar between Jimmy and Joe, and I thought that was kind of cheesy. Maybe it sounded cool in 1991. It doesn't sound all that natural now, or very cool. Yeah, and you don't, again, if you liked Jimmy, the Damon Wayans character, if you liked him, it'd be fun, because then you could hate Joe and like Jimmy, and it'd be great, but no, you don't. You don't like Jimmy either. He's actually not a good guy either. He's all full of himself. And then you have one of several times that Joe should have been brutally murdered, but as I think Roger Ebert pointed out, the script has a problem with assassins that talk too much.
Yes. The monologuing villain.
Yes. So, yeah. So Joe uses the worst jokes also ever. Like, there are two times in this movie where Joe is supposed to get out of situations using some sort of like crazy stand-up comedian skills. And it's not good.
Yeah. So they... they cast a comedian as like the unfunny, angry straight guy. And then they cast Bruce Willis, who is, yeah, supposed to do these comedy routines to get himself out of trouble.
And it's not even like Bruce Willis can be kind of a funny guy, you know? He was good in The Fifth Element. even though, yeah, I destroyed your childhood by talking about that movie. But, you know, he's been good in other stuff, funny in other stuff. This is just not one of those times.
Wait, hold on. To set the record straight, you taught me a very valuable lesson in my childhood, and then you just shit on it when I was an adult.
Again.
You didn't destroy my childhood at all. It was great.
Yeah, there you go. I destroyed the memory of your childhood. Giving myself too much credit. Yeah, so... hold on, sorry. I hit the wrong button here. Back to my notes.
You have buttons?
Yeah, because I've got it on a... I've got my notes on a PDF on my iPad. But because I cut and pasted some stuff from IMDb, when I was trying to scroll from page to page, I actually hit a hyperlink that opened up IMDb's app and blah, blah, blah. So,
see, that's exactly why I don't take notes.
Yeah, well, I had to, because it was like, hold on. Because like I said, it's not like I stopped this movie halfway through and had to finish it at a different time. I watched this movie all the way through, but I just kept continually being shocked about, well, hold on. What was it supposed to be doing? Because, you know, we have the requisite scene after Corey gets gunned down. Yeah, Sonny Corleone, that's hilarious. We get them taken to the police station, where there's a funny little scene about the price of leather pants.
I love that scene. That's such a great scene, and that is actually like some genuine chemistry between Jimmy and Joe, and that's the kind of thing I wanted from the rest of the movie. But yeah, I don't know what happened. It's just all the other snappy banter just didn't land. But that scene I thought really, really worked.
Well, there's a couple more scenes I think that worked, and we'll get there. But so now Jimmy and Joe are suddenly going to be teamed up to go investigate Corey's death. So they find a audio tape of a phone conversation between the chairman of the Senate Committee to Investigate Gambling in Sports, Senator Calvin Baynard, and L.A. Stallions team owner Sheldon Shelley Marcone. And there's kind of a funny scene where the evidence gets eaten up in the tape player in the car. I certainly had a car that you could easily have said, no, don't fast forward, eat the tape. Although, if you're a private detective, even in 1991, you don't throw the tape out the window when the thing eats the tape. You go home and you re-spool the damn tape. Come on, people.
That's right. Yeah. Uh-huh. It's not like it disintegrated.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, he destroyed the evidence by throwing it out the car afterward, but oh well. Yeah, so they discover that Corey found something and is going to try to use it to get Jimmy's job back, which seems very implausible because whatever Jimmy did to lose his job, you'd think would be more public than just getting fired. But maybe I'm thinking of it in TMZ Sports 2015 thoughts instead of 1991.
Yeah. Yeah, and I kept waiting for Jimmy to actually care that Corey had just been brutally murdered.
Oh no.
But he really just seemed to want to get at the heart of what she was doing that caused her death. He didn't really seem concerned that she had been killed at all.
No, he seemed more infatuated with Joe's lifestyle and him being like a sidekick to a detective. Like, that seemed to be giving him the passion.
Yeah, absolutely.
We could have explored that a little bit. No time for that. Got to keep it moving. So that's when we get petered out Joe's history and how it's Senator Baynard, who was the person that was torturing a woman, beating up a hooker, doing whatever. And Joe knocked out four of his teeth and got fired for his trouble. So now that's why Joe is all into the case. And theoretically, Jimmy has a thing because the Stallions team owner fired him. So he's out to get that guy. And that's how they become connected, blah, blah, blah. But I still think it's Jimmy wants to be a detective. So hops on the Joe wagon and Joe just is powerless to stop him. Then, okay, and I like the scene coming up when Joe takes Jimmy home. Because not only do we have, again, what I think is actually pretty effective, again, like the leather pants talk, you've got Jimmy talking about how, wow, Joe's got an actual house. He was thinking more like a cave with skulls and shit. But then they ruin that tiny little line by talking about, Jimmy says, oh, I feel like I've been rode hard and put away wet. And then there's a tiny little conversation about knowing how to ride a horse. It's like, come on. That's just unforgivable. Like, you don't think that's going to come up later, people? And it just seemed like, ugh. I mean, it seemed like the worst way of exposition.
It wasn't quite as bad as just the cutaway to the two random cops talking about how Joe used to be a hero.
Well, yeah. Well, no, but it was. It was as bad as that. At least you were in the police station. You can cut away or you could just keep the camera on those cops as Joe and Jimmy walk off screen and they can have that conversation. In this case, it's more like, hey, you know, we're coming up to your house and, you know, wow, I could certainly use a beer. You know, I feel like that time I was riding on a horse, you know, because I know how to ride a horse and that's going to come up later. Even though I'm a black guy, I can ride a horse real good. Like, oh, stop.
Oh, no, it's just another example of how clunky this movie is. And I really don't know what the problem is, because Shane Black's a great writer, as he had shown previously in Lethal Weapon and would show again to tremendous effect in Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. And Tony Scott is a fantastic director. Like, even a movie like Domino, which I didn't enjoy too much, I thought was just masterfully directed and put together. So I don't know what the problem is. I don't know if the studio tinkered with it later. I don't know if it was an editing problem. It's not computing as I'm rewatching it. And I don't know what's happening.
Is it possible that Damon Wayans and Bruce Willis hated each other or something? Although, yeah, no, you know what? The scenes where it's just the two of them is kind of fine. You know,
when they're not doing weird stuff like going off on tangents about a dead son out of nowhere.
Yeah, okay. So I'll skip over my favorite scene in just a second, but there's a scene where Jimmy and Joe are talking, and Jimmy's like, "Hey, you don't like women much, do you?" And Joe's like, "At least I liked," or talking about his wife, he's like, "At least I liked the guy she was fucking. He's my best friend." And, you know, so they have a little bit of chit-chat to that, and that seems kind of genuine. But, yeah, it's weird. Although, okay, this is my favorite part of the movie. And again, it's all Danielle Harris as the 13-year-old Darian and Jimmy Dix, because Jimmy's got the number 13. And is it shaved in his hair, or is it a tattoo on the back of his head?
I think it's his hair.
Okay. But so Darian is like, the hell's that number on the back of your head? Is it like a license plate in case somebody tries to steal it? And Jimmy's like, no, it's a football thing. It's my high school number. And her response is, so when do you graduate? Like, I fucking love that line.
That's about the only funny thing she said.
Oh, yeah. No, the rest of it is very forced, because she is a potty mouth 13-year-old. That's her job in this movie. And she screams, I hate you, to her dad. And they are acting out in front of company in a really cringeworthy way.
Yeah, and she only had like two settings. She was either like on 3 or on 11.
Yeah.
And that was it.
So now we'll have to wait till our kids are 13 years old. And maybe there's a lot of truth to that. We can return to this movie around episode 1000. But, you know, if nothing else, Jimmy and Joe can, I don't know, maybe bond over the fact that the women in their lives have let them down, in some cases by cheating, other cases by dying inconveniently. Then we get Joe catching Jimmy in the bathroom, like, snorting drugs, and kicks him out of the house.
Joe's reaction seemed really anachronistic. It's, you know, maybe it's just a different attitude about drugs today than, you know, 25 years ago. But, you know, Joe's kind of a mess and abuses alcohol. for sure. And he reacts like when he finds Jimmy doing drugs, he reacts like he just found a bunch of like child pornography on his person. So it didn't really ring true. I don't know if that's just a time and place kind of thing or just bad writing, maybe some of both.
I don't know. I think even though we've used the last scene to establish that Joe and his 13-year-old daughter have nothing in common and don't like each other, I think if I found somebody that I had just met, like in my bathroom snorting drugs in front of my, in a house with my child in it, I would probably kick them out of the house too.
Sure, you would want them to leave, but I think the reaction was a little over the top.
Oh yeah,
it was like, "Get out of here! I'm gonna kill you."
Well, yeah, there's that. Yes.
Like, yeah.
But luckily, we don't. Again, there are no half measures in this movie, because as Jimmy is leaving, he is then confronted by Darian, who asks him to sign a football trading card, his own football card, and as he's signing it, she reveals that Joe has been a fan of Jimmy Dix forever. And since Jimmy was busted and banned from the game or whatever, Joe's never watched another football game.
That's so bad.
It is. It's horrible. It's like, come on. But at least we get to then include the name of the movie in dialogue, which is, of course, a sign of a great movie.
Oh, in the autograph?
Yes. Yep. To the daughter of the last Boy Scout.
Yeah.
So, then we have, as again, the movies, the story's going forward. Joe ends up getting kidnapped the next day by Milo, one of the bad guys. The guy, as it turns out, who asked Billy Blanks to win the game at all costs in the beginning of the movie. And that's our buddy Taylor Negron, who I love. And
he was great in this. He was super creepy. Not at all funny.
No, yeah, he's playing it for real. He's pretty great.
Yeah, no, he was a great bad guy.
Yeah, and, the scene where, Joe gets taken and ends up having the can I have a cigarette scene with the guy from Sons of Anarchy, and, that's a pretty good scene. And the whole...
It's a great scene.
If you hit me one more time, I'm going to kill you. Or if you touch me again, I'll kill you. That's a good line. I mean, I'm sure it looked great on the page.
Right.
And then we have, again, the Chatty Cathy bad guys talking about how Marcone, the L.A. Stallions owner, is going to legalize gambling because there's no money in football these days. All the heroes are gone. So they're going to make their money from gambling instead. So they want to legalize gambling.
Also ridiculous.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, yeah, it's ridiculous, but it's not, I don't know. You don't think FanDuel and what's the other one? You don't think there's any kickbacks to the NFL?
Oh, they're a direct sponsor of the NFL.
Oh, well, that's true. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Well, as are you and I, the United States government, the military. Crazy. Anyway.
Sure. The owner of the Patriots, I think, is an investor in one of them.
Oh, well, it seems like a reasonable thing to be invested in. It seems very lucrative.
Not for long.
Well, maybe not. Yeah, we'll see. Yeah, so then we get this silly scene where they're gonna end up, they've decided it's just gonna be easier to kill the senator than to bribe him, because they tried to bribe him, but he wanted too much money. So they're gonna frame Joe for the murder of the senator.
Very elaborate plan that required the construction of a motorized false trunk in a car.
Yes, yes. A clever, but yes, very, very, very strange. But and then again, you've got this scene where Joe's in this wooded area where they're setting him up. They're gonna kill him. And they've already actually, when Milo has already killed a cop with Joe's gun. Which, by the way, through the end of the movie, never gets resolved. Like, at the very end of the movie, where all the bad guys are dead and Joe's a hero, he's still a cop killer.
Presumably.
Yeah. But anyway, then we have the scene where Jimmy ends up tracking down Joe, trying to rescue him, and Darian comes along, and so Darian and Jimmy have to go and rescue Joe, and they're in the woods, and then there's the horrible scene where Joe has to take the puppet, the hand puppet, and work his way out of the mess with the hand puppet, and it's horrible.
Yes, that was painful.
It was just the worst. And then we have what's kind of a funny scene where and Joe and Jimmy end up trying to, and I'm getting things slightly out of order, but they end up trying to track down the senator's car to let him know there's a bomb in it. And so Jimmy's trying to draw him a picture, and I don't know why it just says B-O-M, and is bomb in Polish really a bad word? And does that actually, has it been established that there's anybody Polish in the senator's limo or whatever?
No, that whole scene made absolutely no sense.
Yeah. But I do like the scene before where they end up at this rich guy's house on the hill, and they want to borrow his car. And the homeowners, or the Joe tells the guy, it's like, hey, you got a car? And the guy's like, yeah. He goes, give me the keys. And the guy's like, no way. And then Joe holds a gun to his own daughter's head and says, give me the keys or I shoot the kid, which is kind of fun. But,
I know what year do you graduate line was your favorite, but. My favorite was just her dad.
Yeah. yeah. It's not bad.
At that moment.
Again, I mean, really, Danielle Harris is one of the better actors in this movie. Certainly, she is the female lead.
Sadly.
Yeah.
Poor Halle Berry.
Oh, she would have been the female lead, but she got so utterly wasted in the first, like, third scene she's in. I mean, she must have been bruised by the number of squibs that went off in her chest. Or maybe that was a stunt double. I don't know how the squibbing works. But yeah, it was pretty brutal.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so then, and I'm going to yada yada to right to the end pretty much, because we end up at the very end where we get the Jimmy riding a horse and using his superior quarterback skill to save the senator. And we get a little bit out of order. We get a little snappy patter, which is not snappy, where they end up getting out of the Shelley Marcone's suite with themselves and the daughter unscathed through the use of special exploding shotgun shells.
Yeah, after for some reason Marcone shoots Jimmy in the hand.
Yes, yes, yes. Well, and okay, I did skip this part, the part where they end up with the guy who they end up crashing the car into the pool, and he's the guy that ends up loaning him the car after he threatens to shoot the daughter. During that scene down the mountain when they're being chased by Milo, there was one scene where they actually run this other car off the road, off a cliff, like an innocent person driving on the road. Like, they straight up murdered an innocent person during the car chase.
Yeah, they did.
Yeah, so there's that. Yeah, and then so we end up having, again, there's a very stylish, at the time, I'm sure, very shocking scene at the end where Jimmy's got to go, I'm sorry, while Jimmy's getting the senator's attention by use of a horse and a football, Joe has to climb his way up after assaulting several policemen. And again, he's a cop killer, remember, allegedly. He ends up finding Milo, who's up with a sniper rifle, going to shoot the senator. And they duke it out on the lighting scaffolding / platform, where Milo ends up falling and landing on the blades of the helicopter, which also presumably crashed into the crowd after. I mean, that doesn't end well for anybody.
Nope, sure doesn't.
Not to mention, there's like, you know, there's machine gun fire, I think, in the stadium anyway. But not great. And then Jimmy dances his little jig to call back an unfortunate line he had said earlier in the movie. And we have Marcone end up blowing himself up with the bomb in a really kind of slapstick sort of way. And everybody smiles because there's been a big explosion on the hillside where hopefully he doesn't have any, employees at this mansion he lives in.
Or neighbors.
Yeah, or exactly. Yeah, yeah. Yep. The entire hillside catches on fire, but oh well. So before I get to the reviews, any other thoughts on The Last Boy Scout?
Well, the very end was also really like forced and uncomfortable, where they're just kind of, you know, there's the makeup scene with the wife where he says fuck you to her a couple times, and it was really sweet.
But in that scene where, you know, earlier, way back in the beginning of the movie, she's like, you know, can't you just say fuck you, or say if there weren't any cops here, I'd punch you in the face or whatever. And he won't give her that satisfaction. So at the end, he just looks at her and says, fuck you, whatever your name is. But he doesn't crack a smile or give her a hug or anything. He's still a super cold guy, at least in my opinion.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, and then there's the very end where they're walking away and they're just like, so I guess we're partners now. Like, really? That's how it happens?
Yeah. Like,
all right. I guess you are, I suppose. Then they sort of have the meta commentary about how you have to have snappy lines now when you engage in some sort of action. And the line, the example they use is like, if you're about to hit somebody with a surfboard, you have to say surf's up before you hit them, which I thought was kind of a funny commentary on sort of the banality of action movies sometimes.
Oh yeah.
But it's a much more clever ending than this movie deserved.
Yes. Yes. Because yeah, I don't know. It's gotta be editing. It's something. It had all the right notes to it. That's the problem. But yeah, so let me tell you about Roger Ebert. I'm just going to quote two parts of his longer review. Well, one thing he said is, I am a reporter. I must report not only the film's willingness to degrade women and children, I must also report the film's slick, clever professionalism. As I've said before, this film works. Despite any objection I might have felt, it plays well with an audience, although some of the people around me seem disturbed by the extended scene in which Willis and his child curse at each other. And then later he says, The Last Boy Scout is a superb example of what it is. It's a glossy, skillful, cynical, smart, utterly corrupt, and vilely misogynistic action thriller. How's a critic to respond? To give it a negative review would be to be dishonest, because it's such a skillful and well-crafted movie. To be positive is to seem to approve of its sickness about women. I'll give it 3 stars. As for my thumb, I'll use it and my forefinger to hold my nose. By the way, people seem to point to producer Joe Silver's history of doing misogynistic movies. They blame him for being part of a bad guy in this whole thing. But Empire Magazine's Joanna Berry, Empire Magazine, the UK, a film magazine, says sort of the same thing as far as, you know, this movie has no subtlety to it. It's really bad as far as like women and that kind of thing. But the quote is, this is a movie for the boys who like watching men being real men, cursing, shooting, and fighting. And anyone who likes this kind of wham-bam entertainment will certainly get more than their money's worth. So that's it. So this is the Adam Carolla of movies, I think.
All right.
So, Merry Christmas, everybody.
Yeah, I was bummed. I really remembered liking this movie. And, I remember coming out of the theater and having that sort of feeling like, you know what? I know this isn't a good movie, but it was enjoyable. So, it was a guilty pleasure. you know, in the very, very sense of the term. But yeah, I'm really bummed. I wish I hadn't watched it again, honestly.
Yeah, you know, and I think, quite honestly, also, again, I watched this, you know, I selected it because it's a Shane Black movie, so it has to take place around Christmas, which it barely mentions. But I may have confused in my memory this movie with, isn't there a movie with Keenan Ivory Wayans and maybe Adam Sandler as buddy cops? Did I dream that?
Adam Sandler. There's a Keenan Ivory Wayans Steven Seagal movie, right?
Let's see. And let me tell you, Adam Sandler, that is a guy who, say what you will, he is very loyal to his friends. Bulletproof. Bulletproof is Damon Wayans, Adam Sandler, and their criminals.
Oh, huh.
Oh, two criminals and their friendship when one of them turns out to be an undercover cop. And then later they're forced to work together when one of them is assigned to protect the other as a witness.
Tell me Adam Sandler's the criminal.
Yes. Adam Sandler's the criminal. Damon Wayans is the cop. It's got James Caan, James Ferrantino, Monica Parter, Xander Berkeley. Huh. Interesting.
Xander Berkeley from Heat?
Xander Berkeley from Heat. Yes, I believe so.
Oh, what a great cast.
Xander Berkeley from 224 acting credits.
Oh, yeah. He was in 24, too.
Holy crap. He's been in everything.
A fun piece of Heat trivia, which I'm going to say again when we do Heat. Xander Berkeley played the Waingrow character in the original TV movie that was sort of the first draft of Heat called L.A. Takedown.
Huh. Is L.A. Takedown available at some place?
I've never seen it.
Hmm.
I also haven't looked for it too much.
Very interesting. So, yeah, so sorry. Sorry I had to infect your holiday mood. Granted, for recording time a little bit early. But maybe we're telling people, don't revisit The Last Boy Scout. There are plenty of other Boy Scouts.
Yeah, this is really a misfire for both Shane Black and Tony Scott, two creative forces that we have talked very positively about on this podcast before.
Yeah, go watch
a lot.
Go watch Man on Fire, followed by Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. You'll be in a much better mood
if you do it in that order.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Mood wise, yes. Send your feedback to show@notinthecreepyway.com or call us on a new voicemail account to leave voice messages, or you can text us at this account to leave text messages. The number is 425-243-9169. That's 425-243-9169. What are you waiting for? Put it in your phone right now, and then when you listen to an episode, you can just hit your contacts, dial it already.